Welcome to The Common Share, a podcast about cooperative businesses. I'm Asa Marshall with Cooperatives First, an organization that promotes cooperative business development in rural and Indigenous communities across Western Canada. For more information on us and what we do, visit cooperativesfirst.com. If you need resources for starting your own co-op, check out the Co-op Creator at coopcreator.com. This is a great resource site that has everything you need to get a co-op up and running. Today, I'm so pleased to share a great conversation with Chief Darcy Bear of Whitecap Dakota First Nation. Whitecap is located about 30 kilometers south of Saskatoon, and under Chief Bear's 27 years of leadership, the nation has undergone huge economic growth. Chief Bear was recently appointed to the Order of Canada for his, quote, visionary leadership of the Whitecap Dakota First Nation and for creating economic and social development opportunities for his community. I spoke to Chief Bear about the impressive economic development success of his First Nation, but he also provided a substantial history lesson before elaborating on his nation's approach to not only business, but also legislation and policy. Whitecap Dakota First Nation has used legislation that gives nations the option to get away from parts of the restrictive Indian Act, but it has also helped shape some of the government policy. The First Nation is currently nearing ratification of its self-government agreement with the Government of Canada. So I truly enjoyed this conversation and the insights about economic development and doing business on First Nation. So I hope you enjoy it as well. First off, can you tell us a bit about Whitecap Dakota First Nation and how your nation's economic development strategy has evolved under your leadership over these past 30 years?
Sure. As Dakota people, we're originally part of the seven council fires, the Dakota, Nakota, Lakota, and we had lands, before European contact on both sides of the border. There was one time there was no border, there's no Canada and no United States, and so we had land. Our ancestors, we had lands on both sides of the border, and it's kind of ironic though, we had. Our ancestors had alliances with the British Crown, even dating back to 1787. There was a treaty between the British and the Dakota about peace and friendship and trade and military alliance. And our ancestors always honored that treaty. And they fought in different battles with the British, whether it be the Pontiac War, or the American Revolution, or the War of 1812. And some of our past chiefs were, one of them was commissioned a general in the British Army. And two of them were commissioned captains in the British Army. During the bicentennial, we even brought that story alive here in Western Canada, because it's important. Some of the comments made right away, the battles happened in Eastern Canada. We said, we know that. Our ancestors were there in those battles. When they did have the bicentennial, they gave medals out to, I think, about 34 First Nations that have ancestors that were tied to the War of 1812. And so we're a part of those ceremonies in Ottawa, in the Rideau Hall. But it's important, I think, to bring those stories alive for our young generation to understand our identity, because a lot of that, our identity, not just as Indigenous people, I think any ethnic group needs to know their history. And certainly for us as well, we need to know our history and, the role our ancestors played. So we look at the War of 1812 itself, here you have Napoleon waging a war overseas, and you have the United States sending supply ships to Napoleon, and then the British intercepting those supply ships through impressment and impacting the economy of the United States. And the president of the day, looking at sheer numbers of about 7 million people in the United States at the time, and about 350,000 people here in British North America. It wasn't called Canada yet. And, he thought the war was a matter of marching, is what he said, and it would last 2 weeks. Well, it didn't last 2 weeks. It lasted over 2 years. And it was a time in our history when you have the British, the French, and Indigenous people, the First Nations people, collectively coming together and forming an alliance and fighting against the Americans. And if the Americans had won, you would have a United States flag flying over this nation today. You'd have Don Trump running around here, but you don't. A beautiful multicultural nation called Canada that our ancestors played a crucial part in those battles. And so it's kind of unfortunate for the Dakota people that, we were viewed at the time of treaty signing. They said you had to be a British Indian to sign treaty. And you look at all the history and the relationships that Dakota had with the British, and even having it, generals and captains in the British Army, and then being viewed as American Indians, not as British Indians, So after the War of 1812, the Treaty of Ghent is signed, and the British and the United States make peace for themselves. But all the promises that the British made to and not just the Dakota people, all the other Indigenous allies that were part of this, you know, to protect our lands and in order, like, if we fought for them, we will protect your lands, and to give our past chiefs medals and things and promises. And they never honored any of those promises. And, you know, so again, we have a file currently with the Canadian government, you know, about that, you know, how you can't breach the honor of the crown, and Canada still has an obligation, and they still have to correct this historical wrong about how they treated our people. So we now have a file that's moving forward. They call it Dakota Reconciliation. And then we signed an MOU with Minister Bennett in regards to a Whitecap Dakota treaty. And that treaty would correct some of those historical wrongs and bring the Dakota into the fabric of the nation where they truly belong. Because, as I say, you can look at archaeological evidence and show that, you know, we've been here since time immemorial. You can look at all the Hudson Bay records, and they'll show all the trade places before Canada even became a country, where the Dakota had made trade. And of course, all of our territories that we had in our northern territories that we had in present day Canada. So the arguments are strong, and we're hoping that that file will move forward. It will also add to some additional land base for our nation here in Whitecap. And of course, whatever we do in Whitecap will set precedent for the other Dakota nations in Canada as well, and for the other First Nation allies of the British during the War of 1812. Because even non-Indigenous people actually received land grants for participating in the War of 1812. And for the Dakota to be treated as the lesser First Nations or even lesser citizens is an injustice that still needs to be corrected. So that's something we're looking forward to. So when we settled in this area in about 1879, you know, like if you look at the majority of the Dakota communities, they all settled near bodies of water, and we got the South Saskatchewan River that flows right through our community, making sure there's also woodlands area as well, you know, to gather wood and a hunting territory. And then our chief was actually approached by a fellow by the name of John Lake, who came from Eastern Canada. He was looking at a place to put his temperance colony, an administrative center. So the chief, knowing the area, picked out a location on the banks of South Saskatchewan that the settlers could cross. And from there, of course, the city of Saskatoon was born. So now we have the city of Saskatoon, which is 20 minutes away from downtown Saskatoon. And it took Saskatoon 125 years. But and this is, again, something we had to bring the story alive in regards to the role that Chief Whitecap played in picking out the location of Saskatoon. And so they did recognize John Lake as our founding father, but they never recognized our chief. And so finally, the meeting happened in 1882. So then finally in 2007, 125 years later, they acknowledge and recognize Chief Whitecap as one of the founding fathers of Saskatoon. And so now there's a statue in downtown Saskatoon, twice the size of life, of Chief Whitecap and John Lake. So as I said, it's important to bring these stories alive, you know, not just for the general public, but also for our own youth, to understand, you know, where they come from and the rich history you have and the contributions that our ancestors have made to this nation and to the area, to the region. So now that statue's there. There's a park actually named after Chief Whitecap as well. And there's the highway that goes right through our community is also named Chief Whitecap Trail. So we've done a lot of work in educating, I guess, the public on the role that the Dakota played in creating Canada, but also the partnerships we've created. And I guess that gets me, I'll roll now into how I got here. So I was elected in 1991 as a councillor here in my community. But the first day being elected, and, you know, we didn't have one dime in our bank account. We had an overdraft. We lacked a lot of policies and governance. And so the easiest thing to do, you know, like back then I was 23 years old, would have been just to walk away. I was going to the College of Commerce and would have been just to walk away, and who needs the headaches? But when you accept the responsibility to be a leader, and you accept all the challenges that go with being a leader, but you need to look at the challenges and find the solutions and go forward. You know, because I've always said anybody can identify a problem. It's easy to identify a problem, but what's the solution? And you got to find that solution. And sometimes it's not just one solution. You could have solution A, B, or C, but you find a solution and you go forward. And of course, you get the support of your community as well. You know, that's one of the things we've also done here in Whitecap, is we make sure we have a minimum of 4 community meetings every year, sometimes more, depending on what's happening in the community. But keeping our people informed is very important. So one of the first things we did was ascertain the size of our deficit. How much money do we owe? You know, because we're in an overdraft. You know, let's put together a financial management plan and let's stick to that financial management plan. So we basically have to create surpluses within the limited amount of resources we have so we can pay off our debt. So we did that. And then eventually our chief had resigned and I was acting chief for a few months. And then I ran for chief. And then my first time running, actually, I got in by acclamation in my very first time. We then had to look at, okay, we stick to our plan. And now we got to also look at our infrastructure. I was raised in my community by my grandparents, Nicholas and Mabel Bear. And we had horses and cattle and large gardens. And so the work ethic that I have today was something that they passed on to me. It was there. They had such a great work ethic. And, we always had chores to do as children, and we still had time to play though as well, So you do your chores and the reward was you get to go and play. But we were, from my perspective, even though we're 20 minutes away from Saskatoon, and we didn't have modern infrastructure growing up. We had haul wood to heat our homes and cut wood, I should say, to heat our homes and haul water, and still had outhouses in the community, no modern infrastructure. And so once I was elected, we changed all of that. In 19, started lobbying the government for a subdivision. We started looking at we only had about 34 homes in our community back then, and a lot of them didn't meet national building code. There was no such thing as having basements. Everybody had crawl space homes. And of course, there was no water treatment plant, no sewage systems. We implemented all that. We put in our first subdivision. We got our first water treatment plant. We lobbied for a new school, eventually a health center. And then we started looking at economic development and looking at the fact that, as Indigenous people, we need to take our rightful place and be a part of the economy. And the federal government purposely, instead of creating a Treaty Implementation Act, they created an Indian Act. And the Indian Act was meant to segregate us from society, keep us out of sight and out of mind, while every other jurisdiction around us had the opportunity to build infrastructure, economies, jobs, opportunities, and even hope. Why can't we as Indigenous people have that same opportunity and have hope as well and have economies on our lands? So a couple of friends of mine, former chief of West Bank, Robert Louis, and former chief of Muscadet First Nation, Austin Bear, they were moving forward with the framework agreement on land management, which is basically sectoral self-government. It eliminates about 25% of the Indian Act. You can develop your own set of land laws, which we call the land code. And we've gone through that process here in Whitecap. And the other thing it enables you to do is to go through land use planning, zoning, development standards. So we got a third party to come in and work with our community, and of course to get community input. Because I think if we had somebody internal do it, everybody has their own biases. So it's kind of nice to get a third party to come in, work with the community, get input from our elders, get input from leadership, get input from staff, get input from the community, combine it, and then bring it forward. So we went through that whole exercise. The other thing that the framework agreement on First Nation land management enables you to do as well is to do the whole environmental health of your lands. There was a number of, say, solid waste sites, like garbage dump sites, that got closed down, and then it got the remediation happened. They hauled out. Some of it was clay capped. Old wells all got clay capped as well. So we went through the whole process of environmental screening for all of our lands, got into the clean bill of health. We built a solid waste transfer station. So now all of our garbage is hauled off the community. It goes into the regional landfill. Yeah. So it's all hauled off the reserve now. We have the transfer station. We have door-to-door garbage pickup, door-to-door recycling in the community as well. And then as far as the land code goes itself, we built in there that we went through the land use planning, so we had the zoning. So you had come to your commercial area or in the residential area, resource conservation areas, places you want to keep natural, agricultural areas, all of that you see in other jurisdictions. You drive into our community, like I said, we're only 20 minutes away from downtown Saskatoon, but you'll come into, as soon as you drive in, there's an intersection, you'll see where the store is, and there's a business park over there. You turn the other way, you go into our resort development district, and that's where you'll see our golf course, you'll see the casino, the hotel. And of course, we got room for a resort community and for some retail in the future and a spa. All those things will be forthcoming. But it's kept things away from where the residential components are for our community members, because we said, we want economic development, but we also still want to have our privacy, so we'll have opportunity. So our land codes, like I said, they're up to 90 on your leases. But the difference between, say, an Indian Act lease and saying having your own land code, you could actually move at the speed of business. So, for example, if the casino itself was supposed to go in downtown Saskatoon, and we're actually part of that group, the Saskatoon Tribal Council, and we're looking at putting it in downtown. Saskatoon had a plebiscite and they voted out the casino. They said no, it was 55% no, 45% yes. So Whitecap was plan B. So all of a sudden we become plan A. So now, of course, we also got to invest in infrastructure. So it's one, we're very fortunate we actually had our land code in place already. And we already went through the whole process of surveying, and part of the, where the casino is located today was actually one of the things that was zoned for that area was all the resort development and included a casino. So it was, we could move at the speed of business. So if we were still under the Indian Act, we would have to designate that land for economic development. We have to do a land surrender vote. We'd have to get the minister to sign off on the lease. And that would take about 3 to 4 years. So the window of opportunity would have closed. But we were very fortunate. We already had our own land code and everything else in place, so we could actually lease the land. So how the gaming model works in Saskatchewan is that all First Nations benefit. The Saskatchewan Indian Gaming Authority, we currently have 7 casinos in Saskatchewan. I actually sit on the board. We have 7 casinos in the province. The 50% goes into a trust for all 74 First Nations. 25% goes to back to the province, to their general revenue fund. Another 25% goes to the local charities around that casino, the catchment area. So the charities also benefit. That's how the model works here. So our tribal council, the tribal councils build the facilities, lease them back to SIGA as the operator, and then, of course, they generate the profits and they get split out. I think it's a good model that everybody receives something in our province. And like I say, we do operate 7 sites in Saskatchewan. So we become plan A. We have to now make these investments. We can move at the speed of business. We give the lease, but then we have to invest in infrastructure. So that was another challenge. So now we got to invest in infrastructure. So one of the other things we had to do was implement a real property tax, because if this casino was located in downtown Saskatoon, they would pay the city of Saskatoon a real property tax because the city has to provide services. So we viewed it from that from a government perspective, that if the Whitecap Dakota government has to provide services back to this casino, then we also have to have a real property tax. So initially we had an Indian Act bylaw. It was a real property tax bylaw. And then eventually we went through the First Nation Fiscal Management Act, and now we have a real property tax law through the First Nation Tax Commission. So that's now implemented. So the tax itself for a real property tax here in Whitecap, we actually use the province Saskatchewan Assessment Management Agency to do all of our assessments. That way any business, if they don't like the assessment, there's redress, but they don't have to come and appeal to chief and council. You know, if they don't like their assessment. It's never happened. I mean, the assessments are fair. It's the same assessors that are off reserve, that are on reserve as far as the RMs that surround us. And then we apply a competitive mill rate and give our tax notice. But it's very important to do that. So all of our businesses, even the ones we own, pay a real property tax back to the Whitecap Dakota government, because we have to provide services back to them. And we've always said we want to make sure that the businesses operate that way, because they would, if they're located off reserve, they would be paying local government's real property tax. And the services we provide back to those businesses shouldn't come off the backs of the community members' programs. We shouldn't be taking away from their programs to subsidize business to be on our lands. So we need to make sure that that system was in place. And then the investment in infrastructure, of course, we had to put in we were told back in those days that the community water plant that we built back in 96, we couldn't use that water plant for business operations. They said, no, we can't do that. The Indian Affairs said this water plant is meant for the community. So we had to build a commercial water treatment plant in our community as part of this package. So we built a commercial water treatment plant. And then, we meter all the water and we invoice for the water that we provide to the businesses. And it's actually it generates a small profit. And the profit we use from that goes to offset the underfunded community water plant that we have. Indigenous Services Canada provides communities with all this infrastructure to have water treatment plant and sewage systems, but they don't provide the resources for communities to operate them. For example, they give us $25,000 for your main operator and $15,000 for the backup operator. Well, in Saskatchewan, just a level one operator alone, based on, we have a salary grid as well here in Whitecap. So on our salary grid, you'd be looking at anywhere from 56,000 up to 64,000 for a level one operator. So then they wonder why they have boil water advisories, et cetera. Well, here's the reason. You're not you're putting all this millions of dollars into infrastructure with water treatment plants and sewage lagoon systems, but you're not providing the resources to actually operate them, you know. So because you can't, a lot of our communities don't generate own source revenue to top up the wages. We're fortunate enough to do that. So we top it up through the profits we make on our commercial plant. We top up the community plant. So we had to invest in infrastructure. That being said, now as we go forward, so now we have the golf course in our community, the Coteau Dunes Golf Links. When we first looked at building that, we're very fortunate. We had a lot of, like, they always say that they give the military the worst land in the country. Well, we're adjacent to the military base. So Department of National Defense is right next to it. So they always give China, the governments back in the day too, always tried to give the First Nations the worst lands they can give us. And so we got a lot of sand, and you come down into the lower area, there's a lot of alkali. We're in the floodplain area, so a lot of the land is not usable because of the you can't get insurance for it. So you got to do infill. You got to build up the land, add infill to make it usable. That being said, we're looking at infrastructure and what do we need for infrastructure? Well, we're looking at expanding our we've got some more projects. We got the golf course, we got the casino, then we're looking at expanding with the hotel and the spa and the resort community, but we have to expand our infrastructure to do that. And so the investment in Canada infrastructure program, the ICEP program, was never open to First Nations in the past. It was only open to cities, rural municipalities. So a number of years ago, I approached the former premier, Brad Wall. I asked Brad, I said, you know, we'd like to access that program. And we'd pay our, like, and the way the program worked back then was one third from the province, one third from the feds, and the local jurisdiction put up one third for infrastructure projects such as water and sewer expansion. So we wanted to expand our water and sewer system. So we sat down with the premier, we had a discussion, and he assigned it to his minister responsible of the file, which was Jim Ryder at the time. And Jim Ryder's actually in cabinet, he's got to be elected again. But so now we had to jointly lobby the federal government to get them on board with this. And so we had to go to Ottawa, and I was in Ottawa. Minister Ryder didn't go with me, but he was said, I'll be available, chief, on the phone if you need me. And when you're talking to the minister, and the minister, so he had the file that time. And so we had the discussion and about this infrastructure investment in Infrastructure Canada Investments Program. And finally we got them on site. And I remember the bureaucrats asking Minister Ryder if the province was really backing Whitecap on this, and he said, "Yes, we are." You know, and they asked him times, and so we basically made history, and now that program is open to all First Nations across the country. But those are the things we need. You know, like if we want to look at doing business and bringing business onto our lands, you know, we have to create the business environment for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And governments don't come forward and say, "Hey, chief, you know, here's what you need to do. Here's the steps you need to take to make it happen." You got to have the vision to make it happen. And so, you know, we knew right away, like, we don't want to be part of the, when it comes to leasing our lands, we don't want to be part of the Indian Act. It's too cumbersome. It's too slow. Doesn't move at the speed of business. And the framework agreement on First Nation land management was a huge solution to Whitecap, to our success. It's eliminating 25% of the Indian Act right there, having our own land laws in place, going through all the processes like any other jurisdiction of land use planning, zoning, development standards, and then infrastructure. Now having access to this ICEP program is very important, because now we have a new ICEP project that's been approved for our community, and that's getting fiber to every household in Whitecap. So by next this coming summer, June, we'll have fiber to every community. And now through COVID-19, I think everybody's realizing how important e-learning is and how important having that fiber capacity to get bandwidth into the households, because you have children who are all, you know, streaming and learning and plus I'm sure they're gaming and other things, but you need to have this infrastructure capacity in the communities. And so we'll have that by next summer. We have it for all of our businesses already, but this will also enhance the business capacity as well for our business park. So we've just the last part of our business park, we have to put in the utilities. So that's going to be happening, and our business park will be open next year as well. So we'll be looking at attracting other businesses into the community as well, so to diversify the economy here. So that's really important, though, is having the, if you can get out of the Indian Act for any First Nation, I'd recommend it. You know, the framework agreement on First Nation land management does so many good things, positive things for the community. Even the environmental cleanup of your lands, so that's part of the package. the whole zoning, everything else. The real property tax regime, I think that's important. You want to make sure that all the businesses are paying their way and it's not taking away from your community's programs. If you don't have it in place, then where do you get the funding, for the infrastructure? Because you still got to maintain all the roadways and everything else. And so if you drive through Whitecap, you're going to see that we have all of our roads and our streets, our subdivisions are all paved. We got street lighting, infrastructure capacity, natural gas, three-phase power, telecommunications, fiber to the businesses, but fiber now coming to every home now in the future. We got water treatment plants, and the water that comes out to every household and every business is better than the bottled water quality. They go to reverse osmosis system. We want to retain our employees, so we make sure we have a salary grid in place, and we have a good pension and benefits program, because recruiting costs you money when you have to recruit. But if you can retain good employees, that's what you want to do. And so that's one of the things we've been practicing as well. And the success is just to see, like, the children to see their mom and dad, going to work. It's no better role model than to see mom and dad go to work on a daily basis. And then just promoting education as well. We had a daycare in our community, but it was the daycare was 22-seat daycare. It was maxed out. And then we talked about, well, let's build an early learning center. And we want to get the province on board as well. We want to make sure that the children, the literacy is a key part of the early learning center, because literacy correlates with retention. If you learn how to read at an early age, you stay in school. So that was another thing we wanted to do. So again, we had to approach the province and talk to the province about being involved in this, but it's being on reserve. And we always get that fight, well, that we can't do this because it's on reserve, that's a federal jurisdiction. Well, we said, well, you got to look at from the perspective of Whitecap as a regional employer. We have over 600 employees, that are working in our community. This early learning center, we want it to be a regional daycare, so it's open to all of our employees. It doesn't matter if they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. And so the province looked at it from that perspective. And then so it was about a $2.1 million facility. Got $1 million from the feds, but got $500,000 from the province. I convinced the Bank of Montreal to do a $250,000 donation, and then we put in the balance. Then it's operational now, and so it's attached directly to the school. You need to have an economy, but you also need to make sure that our people who are our number one resource are getting the education they need going forward. Because if you look at the demographics here in Saskatchewan, there's the boomers all retiring, and then you got a young Indigenous population. We need to get education to our young Indigenous population so they can enter the workforce and become contributing citizens, and of course give back to their communities, right? I've always said, leaders, we might have vision of that, but we also need a good team around us to make sure that an action plan to bring their vision to reality can happen.
Absolutely,
is having everybody involved, so that's really important. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, because of our close proximity to Saskatoon, we're a high user of post-secondary. So the federal government doesn't give us enough, and doesn't right across the Canada. I'm sure a lot of First Nations are in a similar situation where they're not giving our communities enough resources to send all of our students to post-secondary education. So a lot of communities end up with a waiting list. And so for Whitecap, we've been fortunate that we have own source revenues. So we'll invest more money into the post-secondary program and make sure that all of our students that want to go to post-secondary can go to post-secondary, because we do see that as an investment, because, education correlates with the income that you earn in the future. And that's very important, mm-hmm. that we want to make sure that our people have those opportunities and that they can provide for their families. And so, the Indian Act was created to make sure that Indigenous people were dependent upon government. That's why they kept this on reserves. And even my grandfather, to go to Saskatoon when he was a young man to get supplies, he had to get a pass to leave the community. Or if he wanted to sell his livestock, or if he wanted to sell a crop, he had to get a permit from the Indian agent. So here we are living in a so-called free country under dictatorship rule under the Indian agent. And so a lot of these things now are gone, and we want to be part of the economy, and you're seeing it. And so we got a living, breathing model of being part of the economy here, just outside Saskatoon and right here in Canada. And so it's what we've also learned from many other communities as well that have been successful, looking at their models, tweaking it, and making it fit our community.
Excellent. Yeah. And especially as you were talking about the different ways you've been able to get out from under the Indian Act. I mean, I wonder what, if you hadn't had your land code in place, if you hadn't been part of the Land Management Act and hadn't signed up for the Fiscal Management Act, what impact would that have had, do you think, on this economic journey you've been on? Would you have been able to do all these things if you had to rely on Indian Act legislation as opposed to these other acts?
Well, I think we may have lost the opportunity on the casino. If we had to go through that process, it would have been too long for people to wait. So can you wait 3 years? You know, so it's just, I think it would have certainly slowed our growth, you know.
Yeah.
We would have lost opportunities. So it is very important to get out of the Indian Act and even our self-government journey, you know. I've looked at some of the past self-government agreements and the fiscal relationship with Canada. And one of my questions I had to the Prime Minister when I had a chance to meet with him in Saskatoon at the White Buffalo Youth Lodge, I said, asked him about the inherent right policy. Is the inherent right policy a federal government policy or Indigenous Services Canada policy? And he said, it's a federal government policy. And the reason I asked the question is because I noticed that all the self-government agreements in the past are with one department, Indigenous Services Canada. Why isn't the agreement, the fiscal side of things, with all departments that we do business with, whether it be Employment Services Development Canada, whether it be with Heritage Canada, with CMHC, with Health Canada, on and on, you know, like all these other federal departments that are out there, Justice, Public Safety, but they're not, they're with one department. So we need to get those agreements that they are, like basically a full transfer payment to the Whitecap Dakota Nation. If we're going to be recognized as a third level of government, then need to be treated like one and get the resources, and adequate resources to actually close a lot of the socioeconomic gaps that exist between Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous communities. You know, like there's so many gaps, even on the infrastructure side. Like if you look at some of the formulas they use, when I was first elected, they had in their budgets $33,000 to build a home. And that amount hasn't moved very much at all. There's a little bit of growth on it, but the amount of money they're giving us for a house, you can't even build a house. You know, a house is going to cost you at least $300,000, you know, to build and connect it to the infrastructure. And so those things, and yet, you know, like I know the Prime Minister talked about, you know, sufficient, predictable, sustainable funding, but the bureaucrats have yet to start analyzing all of the formulas and start rebasing all of our communities across the country. And that needs to happen because there is a huge infrastructure gap. You know, there's talk about, you know, some new infrastructure investments coming forward, you know, with the Trudeau government. So we're hopeful that that's going to include closing a lot of those gaps in infrastructure that we currently have.
Do you have advice that you would give to other communities, other First Nations that are looking to increase economic development? Are there some general pieces of advice that you give to others that are looking to kind of go down a similar path that you guys have?
Well, I think it's a lot of things, though. Like, you know, you look at our location, though, like we're right beside a city, but I always give credit to our chief, Chief Whitecap, in regards to the fact that I always say he was a visionary because he planted the seeds to our primary market. So definitely, you know, like there's an advantage there. And a lot of people always pointed out, well, you're right beside a city, but you got to remember, we sat beside a city for well over 100 years and never did a thing about it. And so a lot of times it's going to be looking at what is around you. Like you could be close to a mine, or you could be close to some other resource or tourism. You know, like there's things that you got to look at. What can you do in the location that you are in, and what do you need to make it happen? But a lot of times it's going to be your governance and in regards to getting out of the Indian Act, because I still think it's a hindrance, and it's been the key to our success. I think having a serious look at the framework agreement on First Nation land management and how would it benefit your community. I think that's an exercise that any First Nation can take. Is reaching out to the lands, the resource center, and saying, you know, how could this legislation benefit my community? And then from there, looking at, okay, if you want to go down that pathway, but you also need infrastructure. But now there's opportunities for infrastructure, like the ICEP program that's now open to all First Nations. So because that's always a challenge. So you can have legislation that allows people to lease your lands, but if you don't have infrastructure to offer those businesses, then how can they actually come onto your lands? So that's another important piece. I think also making sure that you do have a long-term revenue stream for those businesses in regards to real property tax, and you can call it a service fee. You don't have to call it a tax. You know, you can call it a service fee, because I know, for example, the city of Saskatoon has been very open to urban reserves. And so a lot of the communities that do purchase lands in and around Saskatoon, they get into an agreement with the city of Saskatoon for municipal services, because you don't want to be sitting in the middle of the city of Saskatoon and trying to build your own water and sewer systems when they're already there. Because there's already a huge savings there, but because they already have all the infrastructure, but you need to have an agreement with them. So they get into these service fees and these service agreements and that. So you're going to look at it from a different perspective. You don't have to call it real property tax. You want to call it a service fee, but it's still the businesses need to pay their way, and that's an important part. I think the other big gap that we never talk about, and the governments will talk about, is the whole intergenerational wealth. You know, how in the non-Indigenous community, so many of their great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents bought real estate and willed it down from one generation to the next, and they built up all this wealth. And their children or grandchildren can leverage it, and you know, they can purchase their own homes, or they can go into businesses. For our people, we never had that opportunity to create that generational wealth, and we can pass from one generation to the next. And so that is another huge gap that's out there. And even for our corporations, you look at the Whitecap Development Corporation. I think, you know, like we're probably 25 years old, so we're like only one generation old. Yet you look at other businesses in Canada that are, you know, 400 years plus, you know, that have been around for a long time, have had the ability to retain earnings and diversify and invest in other opportunities and continue to build their wealth. Same thing with from the corporate side of things. A lot of that generational wealth building from corporation all the way down over the years and building wealth, we don't have that. So one of our biggest challenges is always going to be the equity portion, and you know, you might have a good business idea, but you lack capital to get into it. The federal government does have a program called CORP, but it caps out at $3 million. And so it's meant to provide 25% equity into an economic development project. So for a $12 million project, it's good, you know, because the 25% is there, $3 million. But you get into bigger projects, such as like for the hotel project we have in Whitecap, which was a $38 million project, you know, now you're well over $8 million for 25%. But we were very fortunate to lobby the government to lift that cap. But, you know, but that needs to happen. It needs to lift those caps and bigger projects. Even some of the energy projects that are going on across the country, you need to have some Indigenous ownership, you know, so that needs to be happening going forward so that it can provide more opportunities as well and generate more wealth and back to the nation. So, taxation too, you know, we've looked at, besides real property tax, because we're in the tourism industry and we do have, say, a licensed establishment at our clubhouse, a licensed establishment in the casino, a licensed establishment in our hotel. The provincial government has a liquor consumption tax of 10%. So a number of years ago, I approached the province and said, we want to occupy that jurisdiction. We want you to vacate it. And the province actually agreed and said, okay, chief, we'll do it on the condition it's status blind. Everybody has to pay, even the Indigenous people. So I went, we had a community meeting, we talked about it, and it's a sin tax. If you don't want to pay it, then don't have a drink in the clubhouse, don't have a drink in our casino or the hotel. But the beauty of it is that we have over a million tourists coming into our community, mm-hmm. and they'll be, you know, having the odd beverage, and that money gets to stay here in the community. So we use that money to invest into culture and language, you know, so that percent from all those liquor sales. The other one was the First Nations GST. A lot of people don't know, but there's GST in every table game, every slot machine. And so, but if we implement it, then that means that our members have to pay GST on reserve and any sales, even at the clubhouse. So,
okay.
And so we had to again have a discussion with our community members about this First Nations GST program. And that the fact that they would have to pay the GST as well. But again, there's over a million people coming onto the lands that will be paying it as well. And so we won't be the major contributor, because we all have to go off reserve and buy goods and services anyway. And we're all paying GST in Saskatoon. We walk into the mall. So what's the difference if we walk into our clubhouse and buy a golf shirt and we got to pay GST on, you know, so on an item. So We did change the name of it, though. They allow you to change the name because the acronym, when you say FNGST, some people think you're swearing about the GST itself.
I hadn't thought of that.
So we don't call it the FNGST. So we do call it the White Community Improvement Fee. That's what we call it.
That's so great.
The federal government gives you the ability to call it a different name, call it the White Cap Community Improvement Fee. So when you do come out, you own our golf course and you make a purchase and you say, for example, it's WCIF that you'd pay. And the money, not all of it, but about 90% of it gets to stay in the community here, and we can reinvest that money. So we take that money and reinvest it in different, different programs, whether it be for the top up of the post-secondary or we always say to people, we have the coolest elders in Saskatchewan. And the reason we say that is because when our elders turn 65, we put air conditioning in their homes, and we provide our elders with good services, like right to their doorstep, snow removal in the summertime, summer students in regards to lawn maintenance and rototiller gardens. And of course, our health center with their health services and, making sure they get their prescriptions and things. So, mm-hmm. So lots of services. And lately, if some of them need some hearing aids health benefits won't cover it, then we'll cover it for them, because we want to make sure that they can enjoy their years. And if they're in a rental unit in our community, we have a program. Once they hit 65, we'll also cover their rent and we'll cover their power bills as well, their SAS power bills. So just some benefits we want to give to our elders and to thank them for the years that they've provided guidance that to our community. So it's important, and it also reflects back on my grandparents who raised me. Mm-hmm. And we got to say thank you to our people, and they always told us to respect our elders, and so it's one of the things that we always remember and we practice here in our community.
Yeah, amazing. So thank you, Chief Bear. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I just think one other project I will mention to you quickly. When we became Plan A for the casino, the road that was coming out to White Cat was a secondary road. There was no shoulders on it. There was a lot of curves. We knew that if we approached the province and said, we want you to rebuild the road because it's coming out to the White Cat to the casino, that they would say no. So what strategically we did is I reached out to the city of Saskatoon, the arm of Corman Park, the arm of Dundurn, the arm of Rudy, the arm of Rosedale, the town of Outlook, the town of Dundurn, of course ourselves. And we said, let's build a tourism corridor that goes from Saskatoon to Lake Diefenbaker, which is about 45 minutes away from here. And we all signed up an MOA, and we presented that to the province. So difficult to say no when you have one of the largest city in Saskatchewan. You got four rural municipalities, two towns, and a First Nation, actually all saying we want to build a tourism corridor. So the first phase was about $10 million, and the province said that they wouldn't have the money until the following fiscal year. But we needed to start the project right away. So I said, what if Whitecap Bridge finances the $10 million? We'll go get the financing from a bank. So I had three letters from three different banks. And lo and behold, the province found the money. And so the rest is history. So out of the five phases that were built, Whitecap actually managed three of those five phases for the province. So it was the first time First Nation managed a highway project for a province. But also then all of our partners wanted to brand the tourism corridor, and they wanted to call it Chief Whitecap Trail. We didn't object. And so another first, the first highway being named after a chief here in Saskatchewan. So the remaining stretch of the way, so the five phases took us up to the intersection of Highway 15, now Highway 15 into Lake Diefenbaker, and all that project's been approved to go. So eventually we'll have that. But it's going to add to the whole tourism, because we've said that, with our hotel, ice fishing, everything else, or getting out to the lake for the day and coming back to our hotel. So it's only 45 minutes away, so it's going to just working together with all of our neighbors, and I think that's important. Have a successful model. You can't do things alone, and I think we've always remembered the fact that the word Dakota actually means ally. And so our ancestors always built alliances, whether it be with other First Nations, whether it be with the British, the French, even the Spanish. They had all these alliances, and they spoke many different languages. So they always say about how intelligent people are, that when they can speak so many languages, and our ancestors could speak French, they could speak English, they could speak Spanish, they could speak other indigenous groups' languages. So just very intelligent people. And so we're always mindful about those principles of alliance and building those alliances. So everything, all the success you'll see in Whitecap, there's an alliance in one way or another tied to all of our projects. So that's an important piece. And so we always reflect back on some of our what our ancestors thought, and then how do we bring them alive today.
Thank you so much to Chief Darcy Bear for joining us on the podcast. If you have any questions or comments about what we talked about today, you can get in touch with us on Facebook or Instagram, or on Twitter as @coops_first. Join us next time on The Common Share.